on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 94-year-old ex-prisoner of war Bill Overmyer of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and exploring the early days of America's involvement in World War II. Bill told us how he was deployed to the Philippines in 1941, how just hours after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, they also attacked Clark Field in the Philippines. The loss of life was not as great, but the number of airplanes destroyed on the ground proved a pretty devastating blow. Bill, what do you remember about the way you experienced that day?
We were there all ready for action, and here came some planes over. We heard some planes. We looked up. We saw some ghosts up there. There was 54 of them. We could count them, and they were flying right overhead. Now, was that our plane? We thought it was Navy, and we didn't do anything until we heard some bombs whistling through the air, and here came the bombs. Man alive. Anyway, couldn't wait to commence fire, so we took our readings with our height finder, and information to the M4 director, to the guns, fire four rounds each. That'd be 16 rounds. I gave the order to do that. Well, they fired. The darn things went off about 1,000 feet below the airplanes. After 9 months of training and teaching how to shoot at a target of an airplane, we got into action and we found out that our fuses were World War I fuses, powder train fuses. Believe it or not. They sent us right into the teeth of the enemy with unprepared. Incidentally, we had World War I helmets, steel helmets. We had World War I Springfield rifles, bolt action, five shots. We thought we had some pretty nice guns, but they did shoot out pretty fast, about the same velocity as a rifle did. And we thought we knew everything there was to know, but we got an education.
Well, and that's what I'm curious to know. What that felt like that day, because here you've been preparing for it, you know there's a possibility. Then when war's actually there, it's on your doorstep, it's right in your face, and you're firing at the enemy, and the enemy's bombing you. Did that change anything for you emotionally, mentally? Do you remember what that was like?
It filled us with despair. After the bombers dropped, dive bombers came in, and they started strafing and shooting up different areas. Their main targets were the airport, Clark Field, and the buildings. And quite a few of our soldiers were killed in the mess hall and in the buildings and so forth. But we were out in the open in a dug-in trench. Incidentally, anybody that joins the Army or the military ought to learn how to dig a hole in the ground, because that's the safest place you can be. Absolutely. Well, anyway, these dive bombers were coming around strafing, and we had two machine guns in our battery, and one of the guys that was a football player from Texas Tech was on my staff, my range staff. He was up on top shooting at the planes with his little handheld machine gun, but he didn't hit anything. We were all shooting with our rifles, or some guys were shooting with their pistols, but we didn't shoot any other planes down until the second day.
The second day is when you describe that action where your adjustment led to two Japanese planes being shot down. How long did that rage on at Clark Field before you had to get out of there?
We were not at Clark Field much longer. A matter of days, in fact. They took our battery B, and they took half of our men away from us and sent them down to Manila. And they got set up, and they developed into another anti-aircraft unit. They called them the 515th.
But you stayed behind when they left, or you went with them?
We stayed there at Clark Field another day or so, I guess. Then they moved us out and said, we're moving to Bataan. Well, what's Bataan? Bataan is a peninsula hanging off of the bottom of the main island of Luzon. We went south, and we set up for a day or so up at a main bridge at a big river that was just before you get into Bataan. It was a key bridge to allow soldiers from all over the Luzon and the Philippine Islands. They converged at that area roughly and then settled and retreated back into Bataan to make a stand against the Japanese. We had thousands of soldiers making that retreat, and they had to go over this river. Mm-hmm. And we knew the Japs were going to want to blow it up.
The bridge up so you couldn't cross the river.
So we protected it.
You protected the bridge with your guns, and folks, of course, are familiar, I think, with the Bataan Death March and those retreating American forces who were forced into that brutal, brutal march. And you know a lot of those Death March survivors because you're part of the same group, that fought on Bataan. But you avoided the Death March.
May I say that the reason for that is I was on Bataan for several months, and about all we did was watch Photo Joe come over. And he'd be way beyond our range. We couldn't reach him. In fact, some of the days were so moist that we couldn't even see him.
And when you say Photo Joe, that's a Japanese reconnaissance plane taking photos of American forces?
Exactly.
All right.
And we had a man on our unit, his name was Gachapin. He was an Indian from New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And we'd say, "Where is he, Gachapin?" "Oh." And he'd look over, and his black eyes would roll over. "There he is, with match pointers. We can't see him." "Oh, yeah, there he is." Well, we couldn't shoot. All we did is wish he'd get a little closer so we could shoot. So we just sat there and waited. We were set up in a banana grove on Bataan, waiting for action. "Come closer, and we'll shoot at him." Sure enough, they didn't do it. Finally, one day, right the day before Bataan fell, I was walking someplace in the banana grove with a friend of mine from here. We looked up. "Gosh, there's a plane. Well, he's got his motor off. He's coasting down." And I could have thrown a rock at him. If I'd had my rifle, I could have shot him and got him. My rifle was back where I left. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you shouldn't do that. You should never lose your rifle. And my buddy, he'd done the same thing. So this plane dropped a bomb, and we hit the ground, and the bomb went off on the other side of my friend. And he got a terrible shrapnel in his leg. They hauled him off to the hospital. He had malaria already. He never made it. Mm. His dad was a dentist here in Albuquerque.
You mentioned Bataan falling, and I've heard a lot of stories of the lead-up to that from different survivors that I've talked to where they mentioned things like you said, that the provisions were World War I era defenses, guns. They were low on ammunition. And then the food supply, there was a shortage of food, didn't have a whole lot to eat. Were you guys starting to experience some of that?
Yes, we were. We were down to half rations, and then they got us down to quarter rations. We found out, I didn't know why we didn't have any food. I found out that when the trucks left Clark Field to retreat to Bataan, they forgot to get the food.
Wow.
We had food stores galore at Clark Field, and the Japs got to use them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's real admirable. Somebody's, it wasn't our responsibility, but I don't know whose it was. But anyway, we had a crew out that would go for game. First, we ate carabao. It was a form of steak. We ate horse meat. The Philippine scouts were a cavalry unit before we ever got there. Well, we got to eat their horses.
Wow. Well, desperate times, desperate measures.
I ate monkey meat.
Mm-hmm.
I ate iguana.
This is all before you were a prisoner?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, before we got on our way to Bataan.
Uh-huh.
Or after. Same thing, basically. Anyway, we were eating monkey meat, and rice ration was down to something like a quarter of a pound per day or something like that. And we started losing weight. And when we got to Bataan, we were set up in a banana grove, and we used to eat the bananas. They were about 4 inches long,
mm-hmm.
and they were sweeter than pineapple. Boy, they were good. But I've never eaten an American banana because they're nothing like those.
Can't compare to those ones all those years ago, huh?
No way.
Had you heard at this point, as Bataan's about to fall, you're realizing you're in another desperate situation, Did you guys hear at the time what MacArthur had done and where he had gone? Were you guys aware of it, or did that not come till later?
We knew it day by day, everything. Yeah. We had fondness for Wainwright. He would go up the front lines. He would leave the tunnel in Corregidor and go up and check the units and so forth and so on. And he was more or less in charge of the whole thing. And MacArthur was holed up in the Malinta Tunnel. He never peeped out. We call him Dugout Doug. As everybody gets nicknames. Anyway, we heard about him getting a call from Washington and having to go to Australia. I don't feel bad about it. I think it was a wise decision, and the system that they used to retake the Philippines and all of the islands and that area were, I think they were the right ones.
Well, and maybe the lens of history has helped you understand that his strategic importance and what ended up happening, it was important for him to be saved. But at the time, I'm sure there was some grumbling among the troops that here your leader in this area of the war is bailing out on you.
That's right. Well, we just lived from day to day, mainly just standing there waiting for action. It was boring. Really, it was boring. Months after months of just waiting for action. Right after that bomber, drive bomber, dropped that bomb and ruined us, one of our guys, the next day, Bataan surrendered. Well, before that happened, the night before, it was still daylight, and Jack Ellis, who was the commander, he was a first lieutenant, and our captain had been wounded that day. Jack Ellis was a personal friend of mine. And he said, Bill, go down to headquarters, down the trail, and find out what to do. Our communications are out. Our telephones are out. We've been bombed, and they were destroyed, and we don't know what to do. And so I picked up two other guys. One of them was the son of the principal of Albuquerque High School. So we went down this dark trail. We had our guns with us. And about real dark, well, we got down to headquarters, and they were all loading up in trucks and command cars and heading south for the bottom end of Bataan. And I asked, he was a colonel. I said, what are we supposed to do? Battery B. He said, hell, I don't know what to tell you to do. Use your own damn judgment. So I'd walked all that distance and gotten a negative answer. And so I had to turn around and go right back up the trail. And it turned dark by that time. And shells were coming over from Corregidor. Shells were coming overhead from the Japanese. And they were bombing Corregidor, shelling Corregidor. And we got back up to the battery midnight. The moon was out. Bright as day, and we could look over in the bushes over there, and we could just imagine the Japs are over there. And we checked the guns and the M4 director, the height finder, and everything had been ruined, scuttled, damaged, ruined. The Japs couldn't use it. So we turned around and went right back down the trail. We got down almost to the water's edge and laid down on the ground to take a break. It's daylight. The ground started to shake. Earthquake.
Wow.
The land had the same reception as we had. Negative. We got up and kept walking. And myself and one other guy, one of them took off and went someplace else. We got down to the water's edge, and there was a boat out there just aimed towards Corregidor. And it had about 30 guys on the deck. It was a flat top motor launch is what it was. And so we waded out and got on the boat, and the boat took off. We got about halfway over to Corregidor. Uh-oh, here comes three dive bombers looking for trouble, and we were trouble. So we took our guns and aimed, and somebody on our boat said, put your damn guns down, as if we didn't aim our guns, they wouldn't aim their guns. Well, somebody's kind of foolish, not very good leadership. So we put our guns down, and I figured, well, I'm right on the stern, and they're going to come. And here came one plane, peeled off and came down at us. I thought, well, is he going to drop a bomb or is he going to shoot us with a machine gun? If it's a bomb, it's going to get us. If it's a machine gun, well, maybe if I jump in the water and get as deep as I could get, those bullets won't reach me. So that's what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So here come the plane, and here come the machine guns. We looked up. Oh, he's not shooting. What's happening? Oh, a PT boat right over there. Had twin 50 caliber guns on the front and twin 50s on the back, and he was shooting at that plane, and that plane chickened out, pulled away, and left us alone. Mm. And we got all the way to Craigador without getting killed.
PT boat saved you?
Saved my life. You bet it did.
Well, and your decision to get on that boat maybe saved your life. Is that a stretch, or am I correct in thinking that if you guys had not found that boat and had been stuck on Bataan, that you would have been swept up in the death march yourself?
Exactly. Of course, we didn't know anything about the death march at that time, but that's exactly what happened. Everybody that was on Bataan that surrendered made the death march. Or if they were sick, like in a hospital or something like that, they used trucks, American trucks, and took them to the camp.
Well, if you hadn't been spared there, it's a good chance you and I wouldn't be talking right now. Of the more than 70,000 prisoners, American and Filipino combined, who made the death march, more than 10,000 were killed. And those who did survive were faced with years in POW camps after the horrific march. Bill Overmeyer would spend more than 3 years as a prisoner, but he still had close calls to survive before he was captured. And we're going to explore that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.